program here at the Irishman Institute, and you're all more than welcome to this very special class, as a master class of award-winning screenwriter Jeb Stuart. And before we go to kick off, I'd just like to thank the Writers Guild of Ireland, Screen Skills Ireland, there we go, and the Arts Council for all of their help putting on this event this morning. I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to defer to the director of the Writers Guild, Mr. Hugh Farley, who's going to say a couple of words by way of introduction to the event. So I'd like to introduce you to Hugh Farley.
Good morning, and thank you very much for giving up your Sunday morning to be with us. In the beginning was the word, and the word was fade, followed by in, colon. And that's how all the best movies as screenplays start. And today, this event marks the first collaboration between the Writers Guild of Ireland and the Irish Film Institute. And we're very grateful to them and to Screen Skills Ireland for their support for this event. And to you, as I say, for coming along. We hope that you'll have a good time and you'll find it informative and entertaining. So our guest today is the author responsible for not one, but two of the American Film Institute's list of 100 Years, 100 Thrills, their compilation of the greatest thrillers of all time. I'm referring, of course, to Die Hard and The Fugitive. His credits also include Another 48 Hours, Fire Down Below, and intriguingly, an early draft of what became Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull. Will you please give a warm Irish welcome to our guest today, Mr. Jeb Stuart.
Thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for coming along. Would you, let's start just by clarifying why it is that you're in Ireland.
I'm here to do a Netflix show. It's a sort of continuation of the Viking saga that Michael Hirst began, that was shot down at Ashford Studios over the last 6 years. And our show is a continuation. If Michael's show is sort of the rise of the Vikings, mine will be sort of the end of the Viking, which I need to come up with a more exciting way to say that. I think it's, let's say it's the Viking dominance of the world. Anyway, it's a Netflix show, and it will be down in Wicklow.
Excellent. Well, you're very welcome here. Can you tell us, what is the difference between writing for Netflix as opposed to working for the studios in the 90s? How has the culture of the screen industry changed?
Well, I mean, when you've been in the writing business as long as I have, when I started, I went through a graduate program, a couple of graduate programs. When I was working on my first master's, I was teaching a class in, a large auditorium type of class of undergraduate students. And we were talking about media, and that was sort of in the dawn of cable. And I can remember saying, you know, someday when there are 200 channels, and suddenly there was this voice in the back of the room, and it was my advisor. She was a world-renowned media researcher, and she said, "That will never happen." And it was like this voice from God, and I looked up, and she comes down and interrupts my class and said, "You know, Mr. Stuart, that will never happen. There will never even be 50 channels of cable." And I was like, "Well, Dr. Check, that's, no offense, but that's ridiculous. I mean, there, you know, we could go around the room." We started going around the room. "What would you watch? What would you watch?" And within about 2 minutes, she turned and walked out. And I should have known there and gotten out of screenwriting and bought a cable company, because the rest would be history. But I've seen this media change going for a long, long time. And streaming is just, it's wonderful for writers. I'm not sure how much we can support. I don't want to sound like Dr. Check saying, "Oh, there'll never be 10 streaming services." It's not, I don't know how many there are now. But the question is, it's a wonderful thing to write into, as opposed to writing. If you're writing for television, you're no longer having to sell, you know, Ford automobiles or soap or anything like that. You can write a real dramatic piece. You know, you're not tied to a 43-page script that's going to have five interruptions to it or whatever it is in whatever market you're selling into. So you can actually build something that has almost a feature quality to it within a different format. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing, until recently I've taught at Northwestern University in Chicago, screenwriting there, and a lot of my students are coming out of the playwright world. And it's interesting how some, you know, a lot of them are completely unencumbered, and to suddenly have to be in a working environment for a Netflix or a Disney Plus or somebody like that. We're dealing with these issues all the time, but it's a great time to be a writer.
And I see the creative opportunity of long form television, and we see some incredible writing, I think. And the depth of the writing and the quality of the writing is just amazing. What do you think? I mean, obviously, America has had screenwriting film schools at least from the early mid '60s. I think Haig Manoogian and NYU and Columbia and UCLA and USC,
AFI, yeah.
Very well established. But there's what do you think it is about the culture of that film school education and people going through and serving some kind of apprenticeship in low-budget films or whatever that has... Why do you think there's such quality there, I guess?
Well, it's interesting. When I went into a graduate program by default, I was... this is to digress just a little bit, but I wanted to write novels, and I was newly married, and my wife was very supportive of that. And after about a year of amazing series of rejections, I came home one day to I was a tennis pro, and so I came home from work, and my wife met me, and she said, and it was what we would call an intervention. Which is like, you know, honey, I love you, I'm going to support you, but this writing thing, we need to figure this out. And I said, well, we're figuring it out. And she said, no, I've figured it out. I'm sending you to a 2-day aptitude test, okay, to see if you have any aptitude for writing. And I'm like, are those things, do they exist? And she said, absolutely not. I was living in South Carolina, if you're familiar with the U.S. or the Eastern U.S. She had left a great job in Manhattan to come down to live on the outskirts of the world in South Carolina. So she wasn't going to stay there just out of love. So I'm as bluntly as possible. So anyway, I said, well, what happens if I don't have the aptitude for that? And she said, you'll do what everybody else with an English major does. You'll become a lawyer, or we'll go to business school, or we'll do something, but we've got to do something. So I went off to this program. I'm sorry to digress, but this is a long answer to a short question. And the first day, there was a PhD who ran the program, and the PhD said, come in, we'll set up, it's 8 hours of testing. And 8 hours to figure out if I'm a writer or not. I said, wow. But anyway, I said, you know, every 5 seconds I drop the little thing that I wanted to be a writer. He said, yeah, I get that. So anyway, after the first day, I come into the parking lot at 7 a.m. the second day of the testing, and I'm exhausted, and I think this is all, you know, BS. And he's standing in the parking lot with this great big sheaf of computer paper. You know, in those days it was that flip-flop stuff. Right. And he's waving it like, you know, this tome. And he said, oh, my God, we've never had anybody tested so incredibly creative. You're off the charts. And I said, really? I said, wow, to be a writer. And he said, oh, no, to be a florist. And I thought, oh, God, here, business school, here I come. So anyway, I said, okay. Well, he said, don't worry, it was another day of testing. Come on inside. So I went inside. And while I'm sitting there thinking about my life going down the tubes, there was a Time magazine article on Hollywood, and there was a little sidebar article about a screenwriter. And he had never had a movie made, and he made about $250,000 a year. This is like 1980. And he was very happy, apparently, according to this article. And I thought, that's the job for me. Okay, forget about this novel stuff. I have to become a screenwriter. I mean, I've got the failure thing down, okay? And it's just a matter of figuring out how to do that. So I hopped up and I pulled down. I didn't know anything about film schools. So I pulled down any graduate program I could possibly find. The only ones I knew about were NYU, which was a very good program. Obviously, UCLA, USC was really at that point pre-George Lucas, you know, so it didn't have the power, but it was still SC, American Film Institute. Anyway, that was about it. My alma mater, which was the University of North Carolina, which had a great literary tradition. Thomas Wolfe had gone there. It was really great from the fiction side. Had one measly screenwriting course, in a graduate program on radio, television, and motion picture. But I thought I can make that work. So I told my first gigantic lie, which was I went to the PhD and said my wife's father is gravely ill and I can't be here for the second day. I got to go because the to get into that program it closed admissions the next day. So I needed to get all my recommendations and everything wrapped up in that application in. Well, I had to drive 5 hours back down to South Carolina. My wife met me at the front door, and she said, well, what did they say? And I said, they said I scored off the charts. They've never had numbers like this to be a screenwriter, which is kind of like saying to be an astronaut. You know it exists, but how do you get there? So she had just graduated from Chapel Hill as well, so I said, well, North Carolina has a program, a master's in radio, television, and motion pictures. But the problem is I have to get my application in tomorrow. And, you know, my wife, bless her heart, said, well, let's get back in the car. We got back in the car. We drove 5 hours back into North Carolina. I slept on the doorstep of all my professors from undergraduate, got my recommendation in, and 3 months later I'm in graduate school. And then 2 years later I'm in another graduate program at Stanford University in California. And then I did a year postgraduate work on dramatic form. So, you know, that's how I got into film school, which was completely defensive. I was trying not to go to law school. Mm-hmm. And I do think now that I have taught in a very good Stanford University, where I did most of my graduate work, was strictly screenwriting. No stage. Nothing else. There was no other impurities into the strain, and I learned with a phenomenal professor, Julian Blaustein, who had been a great producer. And we were, even though we were in Northern California, we had this flow, absolute river of current scripts coming up. Hmm. So every week we had to break down five scripts that were actually in the agencies at that moment, getting ready to be prepped at that moment. We had a great flow of writers coming up from Los Angeles. I was, as you can probably tell, I was very interested in suspense. And because of the age of my professor, who had done a Hitchcock movie, I had a wonderful opportunity to have private meals with some of Hitchcock's writers. So, people like Ernie Lehman, who did North by Northwest, and I was working on my graduate project, which ended up being Switchback, which is one of my actors, Jared Leto, said it's a slow chase movie, which it kind of is, but it's like a North by Northwest type of stuff. So to have those opportunities were terrific. Graduate programs are not for everybody, mm-hmm. but they're terrific, and now there are many, many more out there than there were before, mm-hmm. and they're quite good. Last comment, mm-hmm. okay. The thing about any program, whether it's a graduate program or something you take online, or whether it's just, you know, you come into it from the acting world or however you come in from to the writing thing, the key about any successful program is confidence. What I try to instill in my students or any writers that I work with is you're paid to be the architect or the guide in this situation. And there's so many times writers are really wonderful about being very proud of your work, but the minute it gets, you know, somebody comes in and, you know, a production designer or a director or a producer, somebody gives the push, it's like, well, you know, you fall out of the art world and you're back into the business side of this. You know, I've got to pay my rent, I got to do this. Writers just have to be confident about that work. That is what, that's the deal. If you're building a building that's 50 stories high, I run into this all the time, where somebody else has come in, whether it's a director or somebody, and it looks great and shiny on the outside, but, you know, to use the analogy, there are no bathrooms between the 20th and the 50th floor. Well, that doesn't work. You know, you have to know your building, and you know that, you know, you have to provide these kind of facilities. Mm-hmm. So that's what, you know, that's what I kind of drive. It, you know, when somebody comes to you and says, I don't like the scenes from page 15 into, you know, to 30, you have to be able to say, here's why those exist. There's a reason for all of this type of, and that's a tough thing, but that's what the writer needs to be in this new world of streaming and everything like that too.
Well, your analogy about the knowing what happens between the floors is particularly apposite in relation to Die Hard. And any of you who've read Jeb's drafts for Die Hard, and you can find them online, it's a masterpiece of screenwriting. And one of I think screenwriting, in a sense, is a great American art form. I mean, of course, world cinema has wonderful writers and directors and so forth, but in terms of narrativity, in terms of a good read, a well-constructed screenplay like Die Hard, for example, is a joy to read. And there are a lot of technical problems that you had to overcome about being really clear on the page about where everybody is without making it incredibly confusing. I mean, people always say that producers have very short attention spans, and you can imagine the anxiety of trying to say, well, you know, so there's this bit on the 33rd floor, and then, oh no, we're back in the office of the 31st floor, and so forth. And that must have been very challenging for you, just as a technical bit of writing to solve.
Well, yeah, and to back this up even further, you know, I was sent Nothing Lasts Forever, which was the novel that Die Hard was based on. I was working over at Disney. I had signed an exclusive deal for Disney, and in at that time, and I'm not sure, I haven't worked there in years, but it was a terrible place to be working, and an even worse place to have an exclusive deal because they wouldn't let you do anything else. But you did get 5 weeks after you turned in a project that you were non-exclusive, and so that was written in 5 weeks. And I got sent the novel, and it was about, if you've ever read this novel, it's a wonderful, good little book by Broderick Thorpe, but it's about a 65-year-old man who goes to Los Angeles from New York and drops his 40-year-old daughter off of a building by accident. But still, by accident or not, I thought it was a pretty crappy idea to make a movie out of it. But anyway, the interesting thing about that is that it was also told in interior monologue. So there was nothing out there. So it's like this blank slate with characters coming in. And once it was taken out of this idea of the 65-year-old man dropping the 40-year-old woman off the building, and it became, you know, a 29-year-old, 30-year-old guy who comes to Los Angeles just to say he's sorry to his wife, and then all sorts of stuff happens, then it takes off on a different place. I will say this, that my idea, and you touched on it, was to make sure that when the reader picks it up, that they just get sucked into it. And when we started production, I got visited by the first AD, and everybody said, "God, this works great. It was just like a Swiss watch," all this kind of, you know, stuff where people were very nice. And the AD sits down with me, and he says, "All right, can we look at some things?" And he said, you start with 12 terrorists. And I said, "Right." And he said, "Okay, on page 6, here are the 12 people, and, you know, I said, "Right." And he said, "On page 10, we have 15 terrorists." Okay. And he said, "And then you kill some of them." "Yeah, on page 12. Yeah. And then he said, "And then, so we're down to 7, and then we're back up to 10. I said, "I get where this is going. I need to go back through and get everything." But I had literally, it was one of the, you know, and it's only happened to me, you know, once or twice. But it went in on a Friday as a read, and it was greenlit on a Sunday. So they didn't have a second draft at first. I did maybe 4 or 5 drafts after that. Okay. But that's how quickly that.
And given that, I guess, this novel, you were hired to adapt this novel.
Right.
The producers who had hired you to do the gig, first of all, how did you get to the point of realizing that this was not a vehicle for Frank Sinatra, which I believe was the original plan, and this insight about changing the character to a younger character with a different situation, and how did they deal with that? I mean, they put money down for this novel.
You know, it's interesting. You'll hear lots of stories, but the reality was, Larry Gordon was the producer that I worked. Joel Silver came into it later. And Joel is famous in Hollywood of, you know, being that kind of out there guy who, you know, like Tom Cruise character in Tropic Thunder, and he is that. But Larry Gordon was the opposite type of producer. He was a small guy, you know, bearded fellow who had done lots and lots of movies. That, but he basically trusted the writer, which is a really nice situation. And when I came in, pitched him the story, which was basically the story that there's a cop who comes back to you know, make amends with his wife, and he doesn't, and then the terrorists come in. That was the start of that particular piece in terms of their. They, Fox had absolutely no ambition for this project. I mean, I was so under the radar, which is such a blessing to be under the radar. It's never happened to me in my career since then. The expectation level is always up here, but the expectation level was below this stage. It was subterranean. So when I turned it in, I think people were like, wow, I didn't realize that. The Frank Sinatra piece is a piece of Hollywood mythology.
Oh.
It's completely, he did The Detective, which is the only reason Fox had the rights to Nothing Lasts Forever, because they had to gobble up everything that Roderick Thorpe had done. But that
had because Thorpe had written the original.
He wrote the original Detective. Yeah. But the concept that Frank was ever, now he might have had some sort of literal, I mean, his agent probably is the one who's pushed the myth. He had a contractual obligation to do this, but he had to be in his 80s at that particular time. I don't think he could have been insured to make the movie. Though, interestingly enough, even though it was written for it was literally written for a Bruce Willis type of person with that type of sense of humor, the first actor that was officially went to was Clint Eastwood.
Okay.
And Eastwood passed. In fact, I've still got the script where the cover of it, he said, I don't get the humor, which I thought was ironic because, you know, he was my ideal for, you know, do you feel lucky, punk, you know, or make my, I mean, he was the guy who, before Schwarzenegger, had those type of action quips.
Mm.
So I was really glad he didn't get it. Then it went to Paul Newman. And Paul Newman said, I'll never do a movie again where I have to carry a gun, which was a blessing for us, even though he would have been spectacular to work with. He made it really clear he was not going to do that. And it began to show to the studio that they had something strange that they couldn't quite get their hands around, which was they thought, and if you look at that, that was the one sheet. That was the original one sheet. And they didn't know. I know now it's like this big action movie, but at the time they wanted to sell it as an adventure movie. I mean, this is the studio that brought you the Poseidon Adventure and stuff like that. You know, there are lots of people. You can see explosions at the top, so it obviously has something to it. And in the very early one sheets had 40 stories of adventure. It's like, I don't think those people would thought it was an adventure. They would have thought it was life and death, you know. But anyway, it showed that they didn't quite know how they wanted to proceed in terms of who are they going to get to act in this. And fortunately, everybody started, I mean, it went to Paul Verhoeven to direct. And he had done RoboCop at the time, and he was like a prime example, and he passed on it. He said, I had one meeting where he kept talking, you know, almost in third person about the Verhoeven touch. So it finally got to a group of people. John McTiernan, who had done Predator, and he was terrified he was going to always be doing sci-fi type of movies like that, and he desperately wanted to do something with, you know, where you didn't have the dreadlocks and stuff. And me, I wanted a movie. I just out of graduate school, I had tons of debt, I had little tiny children to support, and it was like, and a wife I'd lied to about screenwriting. And then you got Bruce Willis, who had done two terrible movies. Well, I thought Blind Date was really great, but he'd done a movie with Jim Garner that neither of them made any money. Mm-hmm. So he was not, as they say in Hollywood, he couldn't have gotten arrested, much less a job. And he got the job, and he got the job with a great price, mm-hmm. which was even better. And so you got this, and so nobody really, nobody gave it any chance. Again, the expectation levels are really, really low, which I think has been beneficial.
Well, we mentioned Bruce Willis and the casting of Bruce Willis, so let's take a look at our first clip. And that is the introduction of John McClane as a character at the start of Die Hard. So if you could take a look at clip one of Die Hard, that would be really great. Coming right up.
I can act it out if you want.
Just while that's teeing up, I guess one of the things that would be... Here we go.
I know, it sounds crazy. Trust me, I've been doing it for 9 years. Yes, sir, better than a shower and a hot cup of coffee.
Okay. It's okay, I'm a cop. Trust me, I've been doing this for 11 years.
So a great character introduction there, but this type of action character was quite different to the Schwarzenegger model that Joel Silver has been kind of associated with, the muscle-bound guy. We see the anxiety. Talk a little bit about how you worked on developing this particular character and also about how you like to introduce your main character into a screenplay.
Well, you know, the you're right. The prevailing, if I was at USC and I was teaching a class, you know, the sort of the mantra is, you know, you only have 10 minutes to get somebody to finish reading your script, you know, to continue your script. So grab people. And if you look at the introduction to Die Hard or even the introduction to Fugitive, there are these lengthy introductions. I think nothing happens in the Fugitive for 20 minutes, you know, and then we kill people and crash trains and do all sorts of fun stuff like that. But anyway, if you can hang in there. My idea, and this comes from the suspense world, was a different approach, is to wind it up. It's almost like a spring that you kind of keep twisting and twisting. I also think that the audience, and this comes from just reading, you know, hundreds of screenplays, is that the audience is, you come into every script as a sponge. And I think sometimes the studios don't give enough credit to what we do as writers in terms of like soaking a reader, soaking it up. So there's a lot going on even in a scene like that. Now, I had been, when graduate school, I had gotten a job as a spy for an airline. So all over the west coast of the U.S. I was flying out of San Francisco to, you know, Spokane, Washington, or Vancouver, or Las Vegas, or Phoenix. And so I was with jerks like that guy all the time saying, you want to know how to do this, you know, and that sort of thing. So, it's important, you know, from a daily situation. This is what I was going through every day. And at the same time, nobody knew that I was a spy for that airline, mm-hmm. okay, just as no one knew. And you can obviously tell this is pre-9/11 that he can hop on a plane with his gun. I think about that every time. I watched this movie years ago in Austin, Texas, with about 500 people, none of whom in that audience were born when we made this. And everybody, the minute I came on, everybody was like, oh, I don't believe that. That was anyway.
Bonnie Bedelia's character, Holly, is really interesting because for the time, 1988, she's a very well-rounded, very independent woman. She's very much... she very much takes charge after Takagi's death. Talk to me about working out that characterization and whether or not you got any pushback from the studio about that interpretation.
I definitely got pushback. I mean, and the studios are always, it's like generals fighting the previous war. Studios are always worried about, and they still are to a certain extent, though they would say they're much more progressive because there are many more women in the executive ranks than there were 30-something years ago. But the but my feeling was, and I mean, I was married to a very, you know, a wife who was very similar to Bonnie Bedelia. She hated going to a movie where the woman is just simply the you know, to be rescued by the guy. Mm. And so there was no way on earth Bonnie Bedelia, who was not a character in the novel, Bonnie Bedelia's character Holly was ever going to be anything other than what she was on screen. Mm. And by the way, that, you know, that's... There was definitely pushback on that. There was definitely can we make her a little bit less, you know, gritty, I think is the word that kept coming up. And I'm like, she left her husband. She keeps her, you know, her maiden name. She's living out in Los Angeles. She's raising the children. You know, she can stand up to Bruce Willis, who comes in and he's an asshole. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, no, those two things, you can't make her soft and cuddly and tough at the same time. I also needed, part of this too was a matter of Bonnie Bedelia was of the same age that I was, which was, we had been influenced much more by, you know, the women's movement than, say, the studio executives who were 20 years older than we were. So it was like, you know, that was the world that we're living in, okay? That was a very progressive world at that point, so... character should reflect that.
Talking about strong characters, Joel Silver and John McTiernan are not exactly shrinking violets.
No.
Talking about a little bit about that relationship, but also in your experience, how did you deal with very strong personalities like that as a writer in terms of protecting the work and managing that, when to say yes and when to say no, I guess?
Well, one of the interesting stories is in the original draft. By the way, it's interesting. You got to be careful about drafts that were done pre-PDF, okay? A lot of people have never lived in that world, but I was talking to somebody the other day. When I was at Fox, I literally would finish a draft. I would take it across the street to the Steno Pool. Believe it or not, it was still called a Steno Pool. There would be 20, 50 to 65-year-old women in there all smoking cigarettes and all with glasses. It was like something out of a movie. And literally, the matron of the pool would take your script, dole it out, and in less than 30 minutes, they had 10 copies of your script. And it went to the producers and everybody that had to be, that was the distribution problem. So, and you'd stand there in the smoke-filled room and watch these women type 10 pages each, you know, of the stuff, and then they'd hand it in. And it was amazing how there were not that many errors in all of that. But, so later, years later, people start loading up, and I bet I did five drafts, production drafts of The Fugitive. And then Steve D'Souza, I went off to do an Eddie Murphy movie, and they needed some changes on the script, so they brought in Steve D'Souza because I wasn't available. And Steve was sort of a punch-up guy. In fact, I never met Steve until last year, after all these years. He was known for a guy who come in and hit a line or two or something like that. And Steve's big contribution to the film, and it was considerable, in my opinion, from a structural standpoint, his only real big contribution was the heist part of it. There were some elements where the FBI comes in. The FBI was in my script, but he ties them in right there. So he spent a few weeks doing that. The script went from 115 pages to 145 pages, and then they threw it out, and they came back, and they brought in the original scripts, and they worked it, and it became sort of a Frankenstein. But anyway, that, I don't know how I got off on the script part, but in terms of Joel, Joel had a tremendous contribution. If you got a good producer, from a creative side, it can actually help. He was bombastic. Roderick Thorpe came in and said, "You cannot change the name of my novel, to Die Hard. Die Hard sounds like a battery. It's like, I can't believe this. You know, people are, my fans are going to be going crazy about this." And I'm thinking, and I was thinking, I was just a fly on the wall in the movie. It was just Joel, Roderick, and myself in there. And Joel listened very patiently and finally said, I don't really give a damn about your fans. He said, "Nobody read your book. The book's been out of print." He said, "You should be so thankful we're changing the name to Die Hard. People will remember Die Hard." And he, this poor novelist who was, along in age at that particular time, was basically told to go sit out in the car and take his check and go buy a cup of coffee or something. And he walked out with his tail between his legs. But Joel's big contribution as far as Die Hard, his number one, other than some phenomenal casting choices, Joel really wanted Alexander Goodenough to be in it. And Joel was also the one who pushed for Alan Rickman. No one had heard of Alan Rickman. You know, he was on the stage in the West End. Nobody, I think he had done Dangerous Liaisons or something like that on film, but nobody knew him. But he was perfect for the role. But his number one contribution, Joel's contribution, was he wanted the building to blow up. And in my first draft, it didn't blow up. And I remember saying, "Well, Joel, there are all these people up there." And he said, "Yeah, I know, there are all these people up there." And I'm thinking, "And you do know if it blows up, they're all dead." And he says, "No, they're not." And I said, "What do you mean, no, they're not? They're dead if it blows up." He said, "That's your problem." I didn't hire a babysitter, take my wife to dinner, stand for an hour in line in Westwood waiting to get into this movie to not see the fucking building not blow up. And I was like, okay. So I went back and I had to figure out how to get them up there and how to come down. And I spent a lot of time in that building. That building was under construction, and I had not grown up in a world where there were lots of high-rise buildings. So I made friends with the building, the construction manager, a really sick fellow from the Bronx. And once he found out that I was a Southerner who had never been more than 3 stories off the ground, he said, "Have you never been in a high-speed elevator?" I said, "No." And he said, "Have you ever been on top of a high-speed elevator?" I said, "No, that sounds really exciting." He said, "It is. It's really great. I can take you on." We go through. We're putting the ladder in. I get up on top. And he said, "Oh, I got to go down and, do something." So he goes down. And I can hear the door close and the ladder being taken away. And suddenly we go up. And you can hear him in the car laughing like some sadistic guy. But anyway, and sure enough, I didn't know you stopped 10 feet from the roof. It looks like you were going to squish me to the top. I mean, I could still be in that building flat as a pancake. But anyway, so he took me through the building, and there were a lot of stories like that. But when we got to I had to go back to the building. And I said, "John," I said, I got to blow up the top of the building." And he said, "Well, what about your character?" And I said, "Well, he's going to be right around here." And I said, "Oh, look, there's a fire hose. I know how I'm going to get him off the top of the building." And he said, "Well, you don't want to do that." And he went over to the thing and he went, "Ching, ching, ching, ching." And it just it wasn't attached very well. And he said, "You tie yourself off, you jump off, it's going to come off." And I said, "Oh, I like that." And so anyway, but I came from a school of writing, that suspense school of it's the old parachute scenario, if you've heard this, forgive me, but it's the idea that the good news is, you've just been upgraded to first class on this flight to L.A. from New York, and the bad news is that 30 minutes after you get to 35,000 feet, the pilot comes on and says, "We're going to crash." And then the good news is there is a parachute under your seat, The bad news is when you jump out with a parachute, it doesn't deploy. The good news is there's a haystack. The bad news is you see where it's going, the pitchfork. So you see that employed several times in a scene where it just is, it's a good action scene, but if I twist it a little bit and make it suspense and then bring it back to action, you can keep the audience engaged a little longer.
I think we should remind the audience of that theory, don't you? Can we go to clip 4 of Die Hard? Gruber's gang have shepherded the hostages onto the rooftop and are preparing to blow it up as an FBI helicopter approaches. Let's see what happens next. Good news and bad news personified.
Yeah, right.
Let's. We're going to move to what is actually clip two, which is introducing Gruber's character, because I want to talk about great antagonists. And I think most movie fans would say that Hans Gruber is one of the great villains of all time. So please do roll clip two, and I'll just keep talking until we get into it. So we'll have a look at the clip, and then maybe you can talk about what you think makes great antagonists and how to make them jump off the page. So, what makes a great antagonist?
Well, in this situation, and now, unfortunately, the Devil Wears Gucci is kind of like old school, but...
Well... Thank you very much.
Yeah, we're going to get rid of him quickly. But for this piece, I always felt like you need humor. And Rickman's humor is just so different, and you couldn't get your hands around him. That was the big thing. You have to write to what an actor can do, but Rickman could do anything. Mm. And so I had always written him to be very, you know, well-dressed. Well, I want him to be the opposite of what you expected in this situation. And so it was really important. It was really, really important to make sure that the audience is not sure what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And until your need for them to be aware that this is a heist movie, after all, not a terrorist movie and that sort of thing. But I will say one other thing about that scene, too, is that scene where it's very difficult to have John McClane in the room, you know, how these actions are happening. In the novel, it was easy. You could just cut away to, you know, we killed Takagi, or we killed whoever the person is. I don't even think it was a Takagi. But it was, you had to put those two in the same room together. And I needed for John McClane to see, you know, to see sort of what's going on, but I didn't want it to be, Rickman could never see him.
Mm.
So anyway, there's a lot of sleight of hand going on in that situation.
Mm, and it works incredibly well. I suppose the, as you say, with Gruber's character, he is, you have this very clear sense from the very brutal execution of Takagi and the way in which he treats Ellis and so forth in the movie, that this is an unrelenting force of nature. He wants what he wants, and he will go to the end of the line to pursue it, I suppose.
This is the Swiss watch going on. And I think, again, remember, I'm writing for an American audience primarily. This is a, you know, an English actor, you know, he's got that almost, you know, you almost don't like him the minute he walks on screen. The minute he starts talking, you know, I guarantee you somebody sitting in Iowa would say, well, that Brit did such and such, you know, he got what he deserved. That's right. Well, there's a method to that madness. I need the audience to understand that all of these things that he's doing are leading to something. There's nothing gratuitous in killing Takagi. He needed to kill him in the violent way he did so that it would show that the people down below, he's going to keep going through this group until he gets what he wants. And that's, you know, and also, most importantly, and this is from the very beginning, the John McClane character has to know that he's dealing with a guy who will, in cold blood, just shoot somebody who's sitting just feet away from him and then move on to the next person. The only person in Los Angeles who knows that at that moment is Bruce Willis, is John McClane. Mm-hmm. And that's something that was crucial to put him in that room at that time, which was not in the novel. Because otherwise, I envision for the next 20 minutes him to be saying, phew, they're bad people up here. And you're like, oh, you know, how do you know they're bad? You know, mm-hmm. And there's no way to tell the audience after that. So that the audience has become my partner as we've gone through the story, so that when a body drops out from the top of the building, is my favorite scene, the whole movie in the script, when Al Powell is backing away and you think he's, you know, he's driving off and no one knows, and this body lands on the guy drives off like a maniac in reverse. And now the audience is like, can share in that moment with you, because they've been carrying this burden around on their back for 15 minutes, nobody believes our protagonist. Mm. And now we're all in this together, and we know that there's a real problem up there. Mm. So,
this cat and mouse game continues throughout the movie. There is the famous confrontation between Gruber and John McClane, where Gruber affects a different accent, and I believe that was a late rewrite.
No, that was in the original script.
Ah, okay, I beg your pardon.
This is where it, you know, it always gets a little dicey. But that, the way that gets out had gone back and forth and back and forth. In fact, it was very similar to how it is in the film, in my script.
Mm.
And Steve did a little tweak on it, and they ended up going back. They actually shot it, I think, 2 weeks, but they went back and did it in the way it was written. So.
Okay. Well, why don't we cue up clip 3 of Die Hard and have a look at this famous meeting where the antagonist and protagonist meet in ways that they really don't anticipate, and they both have to improvise.
Hi there. How you doing?
are you doing up there? What were you looking for?
I'm not as get out of there.
Well, they say failure is an orphan and success is many parents, you know, and I guess an awful lot of people would love to claim to be the architects of Die Hard, but it's great to pull apart such an iconic movie and to hear how you made the movie. I want to go to one final clip, clip five, which is the death of Hans Gruber. And as we tee it up, I guess the thing to bear in mind is just how satisfying the end of Die Hard is. It has a cascading series of climaxes, and this is just the start of the climax.
Such a great delivery. He's great. I did get a letter from Rolex telling me that their watches don't come undone like that. But and I think about that every time he drops like that. And by the way, that was, you know, both this movie and The Fugitive 2, these stunts were practical, which is just hard to conceive today. I mean, obviously, Alan Rickman on a descender, you know, for those shots is you know, very primitive CG, but the body coming off the top of that you know, building was a stuntman dropping into a you know, a big stunt float. And I'll never forget, you know, yeah, did we get it? I don't know. Hugh, go back up and do that again, you know?
So we have a beautifully constructed sequence here where the cat and the mouse get together, and McLean outsmarts Gruber, and we have a series of reversals when it looks like Gruber has got the drop on him, then he shoots Gruber, yeah, then he goes out the window and so forth, all of which is in the screenplay. But as I was saying just before we teed up that clip, that would be really, really a satisfying end to the movie, but it actually has, it then continues to pay off a series of
Well, we have so many characters that the audience it likes, whether it's Argyle, the driver down who we've forgotten about, who's in the garage, and we've got Al Powell out there with his little story. We've got those FBI guys that are there. We got the TV reporter who puts his family into jeopardy, and you just have to pay off a lot of people. And as far as I was concerned, once Gruber's gone, and once the audience begins to sort of go to descend in an action type of movie, and so you have to solve the other pieces satisfyingly, but at the same time, there's a decompression that has to happen, and so that's all decompression from that point on. But I one of the things I just want to point out. One of the problems that we had was in that original novel with the 65-year-old man, he was never shirtless, standing there like this. So, to come up with how to get a gun on the back of a guy who's sweaty and everything like that, that took actually more thought than almost any other part of the entire movie. I remember sitting there for probably 2 days thinking, how am I going to attach this gun to his back? And it was just the cart, which you will never see, except if you're really looking for it, a cart with wrapping supplies, with tape and, all this kind of stuff is sitting there in one of the earlier shots that some employee was wrapping presents for the party. Mm-hmm. And just to show you how it takes a village to make something, if you listen very carefully when we go around and the camera goes onto his back, there is a little bit of sleigh bells, Christmas, it's like, it's just a little bit like that, but it's to remind you, remember that cart anyway.
I think from my own experience of writing, when you solve a problem like that, that is unbelievably satisfying.
It is, but you're hoping the audience buys it. Because sometimes there are threads that are really good, and sometimes they're really, really slender. I mean, and there are a lot of slender threads in The Fugitive, so when we get to that, I'll tell you.
And we'll move on to that now. But apropos of that, I think it works so well because it's a little bit like Shawshank Redemption. Having spent, 2.5 hours with Tim Robbins incarcerated in this hellhole, you don't care how unlikely it is that he has dug his way out with a spoon. You just want that bastard out of there, And it's Rickman is just so evil. It's like, I don't care. Just waste him.
Yeah.
So let's move on to The Fugitive, which is a very different movie. It was released in 1993. It's directed by Andrew Davis. And I believe, did it start with David Toohey? Is that, how did it
begin? Yeah, there were actually, it had been around for 10 years.
Okay.
There were scripts by every major action writer, Walter Hill, Larry Gross. I could go down this incredible list. And the Fugitive had been set in Europe at one point. It was moved to Mexico at one point. The two things that were always in the script. Now, David's script, and I David was another writer I never met until the Golden Globes or something like that. I didn't, it was one of those kind of things where you, he had done a script 10 years before. He was the original writer. And then he was rewritten 10 times by really good writers. And the parts of David's script that remained were actually, there was a little bit of the Hall of Justice scene. But like, he was the original writer, he should be, he launched this show.
I should just say it was an adaptation of a very popular TV series
show
of the 60s.
Which I didn't see. And I purposely, once I got the job, the Warner Bros. Came to me and they said, would you consider, we've got this project and we would really like it. They didn't have Harrison Ford, they didn't have Andy Davis, didn't have anybody. And I said, I like the concept of this. And I said, but if I did this, it really should be about a man who is trying to prove that he didn't kill his wife, not run away from the electric chair. And they were like, no, he's running away from the electric chair, there's a TV series. We want to make Fugitive 1, Fugitive 2. And I said, well, that's the other thing. I don't really want to make a serial. I want to make a one-off movie. And they They were like, he really loves his wife. He's trying to prove he didn't kill her, and you just want to make one of these. And it was like, next. And so then they came back to me, and they asked me again, and I said, the same things apply. And I said, but I've been thinking about it a lot. And in all of the previous drafts, the Gerard character, the Tommy Lee Jones character, had been the antagonist. He had been the bad guy. He had been like the guy who killed the wife. And so there's this ongoing thing. You will never get to the truth because, you know, the person who knows the truth is after you. Mm. And so I kept saying, I think it's a different story. You know, I've been thinking about this more. And it's going to create, you need a different paradigm. You need two mystery stories going on. You know, the Harrison character is going to have to be, have his own little investigative engine. And now I want Gerard not to be the bad guy. I want him to be an investigative engine. And then we've got a bad guy out there that we have to find. Hmm. And they went, next. You know, that's just way over my head. And suddenly I got a call from Warner Brothers one afternoon, and they said, you're hired. We love all those ideas. And I thought, wow. Wow, that's really great. I've really arrived. You know, the studio is calling me and saying, and then when I first met Harrison Ford, he said, you know, I told Warner Brothers the only way I'm going to do this movie is we only make one, and that I love my wife, and I need to be doing something, like doing an investigation, mm-hmm. somehow or another like that. And I thought, I haven't arrived at all. I just...
you just lucked out.
Yeah, I did.
And actually, that tweaking is really important because it seems to me Kimball is the main character, but Gerard is really the protagonist because he's the one who changes. Kimball doesn't really change.
No.
Which typically for a protagonist, they must by definition change. But it's possible to have a main character in a story and a protagonist who is not the main story.
But the audience doesn't know that.
No.
That's the key. The audience thinks that Gerard. Now, I made a lot of changes from the original too, in that in the United States, the U.S. Marshals Service is not the FBI. The U.S. Marshals Service basically delivers summons to go to court, and they hunt down, you know, federal fugitives who get away, and that's a very minor part of their job. They are not investigators. Zero. If you are convicted, you've lost your rights. In other words, you're I don't have to read you the Miranda rights. You know, everything you say and do will be held against you. Forget that. It's gone. And so I made that change because, for me, that added more suspense to the character, because if I could create a really badass marshal who would, and you believe, would pull a trigger without saying stop, okay, then you're going to be more worried about Richard Kimball. And so I went and spent time with U.S. Marshal Services, and I was going to make them really hot and sexy and, you know, really smart and everything like that. And to be a U.S. Marshal, and I hope there are no U.S. Marshals in this room, but you need a 6 weeks course, which basically teaches you how not to drop your handgun, okay, and how to deliver a summons. Marshals in the United States get shot, and this is, you know, you're going to think we're the most lawless place. We are the most lawless place in the world right now. But more marshals get shot every month delivering summons to go to court. You know, you knock on door at a mobile home in South Georgia and you say, you know, this is U.S. Marshal, you know, your summons to go to court. Bang. Okay. I don't like that summons, you know. So anyway, so the marshal service is not the sharpest tool in the shed, so to speak. But I wanted to make it a little bit better. So I spent some time with them. But we did have some issues with the marshals that we can talk about later.
Okay. So if it's okay for our projection team, what I'd love to do is I'd like to look at clip 4 of The Fugitive and clip 6, and maybe a slight gap between delivering both of those. I'm just going to keep talking because I think this issue, it's a really interesting kind of structural thing that Kimball, who is the main character, has an investigation story. He's very much front and center, but he doesn't really change. So in clip 4, we're going to see it's about halfway through the piece where they first come face to face, and then we're going to see a clip at the very end.
I don't care!
Wonderful. And we'll have six very shortly.
Well, that was a big piece.
Yeah.
You know, the audience needs to know, if we couldn't care less about what
Get
Kimball
out,
found.
It's time to stop running!
So many, unlike Die Hard, and I don't recommend this for anybody, I had to write The Fugitive as we shot it, okay, which is not a good way to do a suspense thriller. You kind of need to know where it's going, and you have to work with a really good, or you have to work with a director who will just shoot what you're sending there, and the actors had to work. But in that very first clip, I brought back, I got flop sweat sitting here. I just could feel it running down the back of my neck. That scene where they're standing there, and Kimball pulls the gun on Tommy Lee Jones, they're supposedly in these tunnels right near the dam. And we built on about an acre of, well, at least a half an acre inside a big Westinghouse soundstage in Chicago, and it was just cold as hell. It was just terribly bitter inside. There's no heat. It's an empty building, and the production designer had built this maze. It was like a water park of tunnels that we could pop up the top and shoot, and it was great. But they could splash around, and we could move the tunnel, and there were places for a steady cam. And we got to this the scene, this particular scene. Now remember, in The Fugitive, we don't have Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones together, but for three times in the entire movie, and this was the very first time. And Harrison did his lines, and then the camera comes back around on Tommy, and Tommy refused to say his line. And he said, "It doesn't give me anything to do. It just says I don't care." And I said, "Well, it's an important line because it's huge for the audience to know that you'll." You kill this man. You know, you don't care. You don't care about his story. It's important. And he said, I think he does care. And I said, I don't know. He said, let's come up with some other lines. Come up with some other lines. It's 34 degrees. It's like, you know, we're standing in water. Harrison Ford is standing there. He's already done his stuff for the day, and he's being a nice actor to give his lines back. And Tommy keeps the crew. You know, we got 100 people standing there. And he kept feed me a different line. It's cold in here, you know, and he said, it's too cold today, you know, Tommy's riffing off it. It goes to, we go for about 15, 20 minutes, and finally I said, no, tell me, what was that? He said, yeah, try, I don't care. He said, oh, that's interesting. I don't care. No, that sounds familiar. And everybody in the director says, cut, print, you know. And Harrison just busts out laughing, you know, he's just standing there the whole time. So we had a couple of those, including the famous outhouse, you know, scene. He wasn't going to say that line. Yeah, so.
I believe also Russell Crowe in Gladiator didn't want to do Am I Not Amused?
Right.
Sometimes actors just don't know what's good for them.
That's
and honestly, probably the rest of the production team don't always. You just don't know what's going to become that iconic moment. Like, this one, which we're going to show now, clip 3 of The Fugitive, which is Gerard's speech.
Yeah.
If we can tee that up. And maybe as we're writing into it, you might just talk about this issue of how to write for an actor. You're writing for a star, you're writing for Tommy, you're writing for Harrison. Clip's just coming up in a moment, and we'll pick up that theme when the clip is over.
Ladies and gentlemen, our fugitive has been on the run for 90 minutes.
Average foot speed over uneven ground barring injury is 4 miles an hour. That gives us a radius of 6 miles. What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area. Checkpoints go up to 15 miles. Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball. Go get it.
That was actually not shot by Andy Davis. We were under an incredible time constraints. That was, we had moved the production from Chicago down to North Carolina, where I was from, because we needed a dam, and we needed a train that we could destroy. And you can do anything like that in North Carolina. You can't do any of that in Chicago. So the whole company went down to North Carolina, and I moved my office to a little Holiday Inn in Cherokee. And one night at 2 a.m., Warner Brothers sent a trailer unit, a unit to come shoot the trailer for the movie. Mm-hmm. And Tommy was, Harrison wasn't in the scene, even though he's running, that's just another shot. And he wasn't going to say any of his lines. And the director, poor guy who had been brought in from Los Angeles, said, "I can't get him to come out of his trailer." So I, 2 a.m., get in the car and go all the way out there, and we start talking about the script. And I said, "You know, it's been in the script forever." You know, and he said, "I know, but we can make it better." And it was one of the, I had worked with Tommy before. Part of this problem is not, I'm not telling you bad, that Tommy is difficult to work with. He just hates me. I had done a movie at Disney about 2 years before that he and Nicolas Cage were in. It was a helicopter movie, and it was I hadn't written it, but it was given to me in post-production. They'd already shot it, and it was called Wings of the Apache, and it ended up being called Firebirds or something like that afterwards. But anyway, I had to rewrite this. The movie was unreleasable, and I had to rewrite the whole movie in post, 40 pages of ADR where we were putting in new dialogue and stuff like that. And then I had to bring the actors back in from wherever they were and have them dub all these lines in, which took days. And I got Nick Cage in. He was great. I got Sean Young came in. She was great. And finally, Tommy comes in, and by that time, I was like the stud guy who I'm pulling. Everybody loves it, and it's right, making sense and stuff like that. And Tommy looks at the whole thing, and then finally, he says to all of the engineers on the ADR stage, he said, "Could you all just give Jeb and I just a few minutes?" And so they all leave the stage, and I turn around, and he's got a love seat. He throws a love seat at me, okay? And he said, "Did you ever fucking think why this movie is like this right now?" And I said, "No." Well, they had to shoot it during the writer's strike. It was a writer's guild strike, so the writer wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So he said, "Do you know who wrote that?" And it just dawned on me. Tommy wrote that script. That I have just spent hours, weeks rewriting, cutting, putting new dialogue in, and everybody telling everybody it was terrible. So anyway, when he was cast for this, it was like, "I'm going to make your life a living hell," which he pretty much did. And of course, I gave him an Oscar. But anyway, this scene he didn't want to do, but we got through it. He shot it, and there's a little bit of, every time I see it, it gets cockier and cockier in terms of that situation. But that's why it's shot in this big close up and everything like that.
Interesting. Let's take another look, which is also with Tommy Lee. This is going to be clip 5 of The Fugitive. And it's really unusual because it's a sequence that really doesn't need to be there in a 2-hour, 11-minute movie. It's the aftermath of the apprehension and killing of the other escapee. You could have cut that story entirely, but there's a gorgeous little speech that he has, yeah, which says an awful lot about character. Coming up.
I can't hear anything. My ears. Can't believe you did that. You think I should have bargained with that guy? Yeah. I do. You could have missed. You could have killed me.
Yeah. How bad's that ear?
It's terrible. I'm gonna have permanent hearing damage.
Let me see it. Can you hear what I'm saying now?
Yeah.
I don't bark. You hear that?
Yeah.
Well, I'll take a little the other stance on that scene, because earlier in the scene, that scene, if you hadn't seen the movie, there was another fugitive who got away, Copeland, and he, Tommy, or the Gerard character, shoots him literally, you know, point blank range, and he obviously doesn't negotiate. And we had, for me, that was really important because for two reasons. One, from a suspense standpoint, we actually think that they're closing in on Kimball's hideout, mm-hmm. when in fact they're closing in on somebody else. And it's a good way to, you know, otherwise I got this character named Copeland roaming around out there that there's no closure to his situation. Mm-hmm. So I have to have that done. But I don't bargain is one more reminder that if he ever gets Kimball in this situation, he's going to kill Kimball too. Mm-hmm. And he won't think about it. He's not going to hesitate.
But the other thing about it is that scene, and there's a couple of other scenes, for example, the interrogation, the first interrogation of Harrison Ford's character, that even though this is an adventure story that has got trains crashing and jumps from dams and helicopters shooting at him on the rooftop, what holds it together is little scenes like that that feel they have the tang of authenticity about them. They're played in a very naturalistic way that counterpoints these bigger moments.
Yeah, I mean, that part is really crucial. And the other part was really great was the choice of shooting in Chicago. Andy Davis was from Chicago. Again, going back to the architecture of how we did it, we didn't have a script. I had to fly out to Jackson Hole and pitch a story to Harrison that was I just made up on the plane, and then he got him on board, which is a whole other story. And then they brought in Andy Davis, who then hopped on a plane and flew out, and he's shooting a movie he doesn't have a script for, and he only has a star. Mm-hmm. So there is the one thing Andy brought. He was a former DP. He was a former camera operator. Is our scenes like this? I mean, he can take a script and he can make it. You know, it's wonderful. He knows in Chicago it's, you know, it's gritty, and he knows all of those places to go shoot, which is just invaluable in terms of giving you what you're talking about, a believability, a sort of verisimilitude to the place.
Much the last half hour of the film is taken up with exposition, with revealing Sykes' identity. Sykes is the one-armed guy. His link to Lentz, who is a doctor involved with a dodgy pharma company called Devlin McGregor. And then how there is drug trials, and then eventually how Charles Nichols. That's a ton of exposition to deal with.
Yeah, it is. And I'll tell you, again, this goes back to Exhibit A. Don't write a suspense thriller where you don't know how it's going to end, okay, until you get there. We shot about 60% of the movie, maybe 65% of the movie, and production hasn't seen how it all explains itself. And I really got to, I couldn't figure it out. I'll admit to you, I could not figure out how to end The Fugitive. And I finally, you know, I got closer and closer and closer to the edge. We had a big production meeting at 8:00 the next morning. It's 1 a.m., it's 2 a.m., and I give up. I give up. I don't know. I've got all these strands of the story. It's a real complicated story, and I got this guy Lentz, and I got all these pieces. And finally, I turn off the light at 2 a.m., and I was going to go in at 8 and say, I ain't got nothing. And I knew I'd be fired. They'd already fired me once. They fired me because I wouldn't put Harrison Ford in bed with Julianne Moore. okay, Warner sent an executive out. They said, we hired her to get in bed with him. And I said, you do realize he's proving, this whole movie is about him proving he didn't kill his wife. And now you're going to have me shack up with her. Okay. And they said, we don't care. And then they went down the hall and told Harrison they just fired me. And he, anyway, I don't know what happened in that room, but I do know that 30 seconds later, they walked back and said, you're not fired. And so anyway, back to the other, I knew at 8 o'clock I was going to go in and I'd be fired. I've just taken a $90 million Warner Brothers tentpole movie and drove it over the cliff. And turn off the light at 2 a.m. At 2:05, I turn on the light, and I thought, I know how to end this thing. And I wrote it all out. I mean, I literally wrote the next 25 pages, copied it, turned it into the, you know, our production meeting the next day. Everybody reads it at the table, and they went, this is great. You know, makes lots of sense. What took so long to do this thing? And I'm like, oh, you know, I just want to keep you guys guessing. So the gifts, as Faulkner says, the gifts of the subconscious sometimes are really powerful. But that's why you get all of that exposition in the, you know, at the end of the second act and third act of this movie. The strains are all there. And if you've got wonderful editors, they become apparent after the fact. But going back to my Hitchcock roots, you know, they will tell you the audience really doesn't care about lengths. It doesn't. They don't care about the MacGuffin that's going on. All the pharma stuff is just the MacGuffin in the thing. And I had been telling myself that for weeks, months, and that's where they. But if the MacGuffin still has to work, okay, it still has to. There has to be something so that people can look back at that. But anyway, that's why you get that big hunk of exposition that's sort of sitting right there.
And it does make sense, but there's a ton of stuff to get through. Because you're desperately trying to hide Charles Nichols' role in it.
Well, you have to do that. The other thing is, I just think the audience is, we had so many issues. The Charles Nichols role, who was played by the Dutch actor, Jeroen Corbe,
yeah.
We actually started shooting, and we shot the first part of the future. If you look at the beginning where he's at the party with his wife, and Celia Ward, and he walks around, he's got the beard that he grew for the show and everything like that. The other actor, who was Dr. Nichols, we shot him. We went down to North Carolina, shot for 6 weeks. We came back, and we found that our Dr. Nichols had died unexpectedly of a brain hemorrhage. And as tragic as that was, Harrison was worried because he'd shaved off his beard. And now we had to go back and reshoot with a new actor. And he didn't want to wear a prosthesis, and it was kind of, I mean, a prosthesis. He didn't want to wear, you know, a fake beard. And so Jeroen came in, and we had to shoot all that stuff. And there we were able to mask it a couple of different ways and stuff like that. But it's even harder. So when we were shooting that scene, the director would be putting up these signposts that it's Devlin McGregor, okay, pharmaceutical company. There were signs everywhere in this auditorium, and I came in and I was going in and pulling them all down because I didn't want the audience to know that it was Devlin. And no one knew where the story was going to go, so they're throwing things out there. It's like the gift cart in Die Hard. You know, it better play a part, but it also can't tell the audience in the first 5 minutes, oh, I know who the bad guy is. It's a pharmaceutical company.
We are coming to the end of our session, and we have a few minutes to take some questions from the audience. So if you have, there's a gentleman here. Just wait for a second, we'll get a microphone to you. Thank you.
You teach a lot, and I'm just wondering, what's the best piece of advice you ever got about screenwriting? I'm thinking of things along the lines of nothing is as it appears. That kind of thing.
The best piece of screenwriting advice actually came from Julie Epstein. Julie Epstein wrote Casablanca. And when I met him, he was, you know, in his 80s, I guess, at that time. He wrote it with his brother, by the way. But his piece of advice to me was because I was going through all these complex things. What's the secret sauce? What's all this kind of stuff? And he said, entertain yourself. And, you know, in this world where we now digest, you know, thousands of hours of media, and it's so accessible to us, we're experts. Everybody in this room is a expert by that notion that, you know, you spend 10,000 hours looking at it and doing anything, you become a pro. And what his point to me was, you got into this for a reason. You're a consumer yourself. Don't bullshit yourself. If you make sure that you are being entertained, and trust the fact that you have some value. You know the story that you're telling better than anybody else, but it better entertain you. If it entertains you, it'll entertain everybody else.
This gentleman here. Just wait for the mic.
I hope it doesn't go off.
Yeah, it's not going off great. So, love Die Hard. There are multiple scenes where John is by himself in the building. When should a one-person moment be just a nice silent moment, and when should you have dialogue? In this movie's case, of course, there was three, they're talking by himself or the walkie-talkie. When to have the silent moment, and when to say, I should have a nice line of dialogue in here, I should have a nice bit of, you know...
I think that depends on the character, and Willis's character was this sort of smart-ass guy from New Jersey and that sort of thing, and having lived in that part of the country for a long time, there are a lot of guys like that. So he felt very comfortable delivering lines like that, coming up with lines like that, improving lines like that. But part of that style came from the fact that I'd never written an action movie. And I would write a big action scene, and then I would feel kind of like I need to go take a shower. You know, it's like, nobody would believe that. And so it helps to throw in a line like, you know, flipping on the cigarette lighter and saying, you know, come to California, you know, hang out. You know, it's you can hear it in there of, I don't even believe this is happening to me. Mm. You know, so that's, but you need the right character. If it had been Clint Eastwood, you would have believed, of course it's going to happen to you. You know, you're Clint Eastwood.
Actually, that's a really interesting point, because in a sense, Ford's character, who is Die Hard, both McClane and Ford's character in The Fugitive, they're loners trying to solve a bigger thing.
Right.
McClane is very verbal, but actually Harrison Ford has very few lines of dialogue. You see all of his kind of shoe leather scenes of investigating, but he actually doesn't talk to himself in the way that McClane does.
Harrison is much more in the Gary Cooper category. He's very laconic. He's a great actor to work with. I've done 5 projects with him. Excuse me. And he doesn't get the credit that he deserves. He's got smirks, he's got smiles. When he really does give you a smile, it's really warm and special, because most of the time he's just kind of smirking, like when Tommy said, I don't care. And so you have to write to who you've got to work with.
Any other questions? Let's take one from this gentleman over here.
It's Die Hard, a Christmas movie.
that's an easy one. While they're passing the mic, I'll tell you. Yeah, you know, you had to have that building empty, and Christmas Eve is a great time to empty a building, so no one's going to be around like that. But I always wanted, you know, the studio wanted it to snow, and I said, I'll compromise and we'll have all these bear bonds come raining down. It's snowing.
Nice. Sir.
I just wonder, how was your experience on the sequel to 48 Hours? There was a lot of egos on that movie. You got Walter Hill, you got Eddie Murphy, and Joel Silver as well. Remember?
Yeah, Paramount did not want to make that movie. I went in to meet Eddie wanted me to write a story for him, and write a script for him that he and one of the Wayans brothers had done. And it was incredibly funny. I mean, I just laughed and laughed and laughed. And he said, so you'll write it? And I said, no, I mean, there's nothing for me to do. You should just bring in, you know, an assistant secretary or somebody to just dictate. And he said, well, what? I want to do something. What will we do? And as I was getting ready to leave, I said, oh, you know, if you ever wanted to do another 48 hours, you know, I would be your guy. And over Eddie's shoulder, if you were Eddie, over your shoulder was the Paramount executive, and the Paramount executive is going, no. Because to your point, when they hired Eddie to do the original 48, they paid him like nothing. Nick Nolte was sort of a washed-up actor at the time who kind of got his rebirth with 48. Joel Silver and Larry Gordon, who produced it, got nothing. Walter Hill got nothing. Now all of those guys would be in the multiple millions of dollars. So the above-the-line part of the budget is probably $20 million before we've even gotten to the writer. And there's no script and that sort of thing. So Paramount had a good reason to say, don't, we're not doing that. And he's like, I love that idea. And then he looks around at the executive like that, and the guy's going, yeah, we do too. But he's a terrific person to develop with. He's a good guy. He's a funny guy. But that was a sequel that I kind of wish I had not been a part of. It was hard.
We'll take one last question. There's a person at the very back there. Yes. Microphone coming over to you now.
Hi, Florian. I was just wondering, how do you feel when somebody has a really good idea for your script, but it's not your idea? Like, it's an amazing idea, but you didn't think of it. Do you feel bad that you didn't have this amazing idea, or do you think that best idea wins?
No, I've kind of come a long way on that. You know, until you start making stuff, you feel a little bit more possessive of what it is. I don't feel that way at all. I think it's, you know, if you're in the business of just holding, you know, to what you're doing, you should be in the poetry business, okay? But we're in the drama business, and one of the neat things about it is it's an amalgam of phenomenal talents. It's, if you've written something good, it should launch a thousand ships. I mean, people should have ideas. If you've written something bad, sometimes it launches a different fleet of ships, which is how are we all going to make this better. But it, every now and then, it's really great when somebody comes up. There are very few times that I haven't gone down one street or another to you know, find stuff. I'm not talking about lines of dialogue, but I'm talking about a really big idea that I should have seen. But I don't have a problem. The bigger issue is when you're going to the set and somebody has told the driver of the director, has had this brilliant idea in his sleep, and so the driver tells the director that these two characters should kill each other and that would be a great idea. And then the director gets to the set and said, I had a great idea today. These two characters should kill each other. And I'm like, what? And are you crazy? So you got to know what will work and what just is a terrible idea.
Well, that's a really good place to draw this event to a close. I have loved every second of it, and I am so grateful to you, Jeb. Maybe you'd give it up for Jeb Stewart.